You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
A year ago, most of us were likely to associate the word occupied with airplane restaurant doors, and tiger blood was reserved for actual felines rather than self-destructive celebrities. In 2011, these terms, along with a long list of others, new or repurposed, came into common use in discussions of national and global politics, culture, and our way of life. On January 6th, the American Dialect Society will convene to select a definitive word of the year. And overseeing that decision will be Ben Zimmer, the chair of the ADS's New Words Committee. He's also the executive producer of VisualThesaurus.com and Vocabulary.com, a former on-language columnist for the New York Times and the writer of a biweekly language column for the Boston Globe. This Sunday's installment of his column will reveal a list of the word nominees, but we are very lucky that Ben Zimmer could join us today to give us a preview and to field some of your own suggestions for Word of the Year. You can leave a comment on our show page at WNYC.org or call in at 212-433-9692 in case we don't cover your word. And that column, by the way, the column in next Sunday's Boston Globe will be made available with a link when it is available to us. Okay. So, Ben, you studied linguistics as an undergrad and linguistic anthropology as a PhD student. What is linguistic anthropology?
Well, linguistic anthropology is the study of language in its cultural context. So not language in a kind of a vacuum, but really understanding the sort of cultural, social, and political implications of language use.
So that comes into play for our discussion today. And if we were in another country, we'd be talking about a whole different set of words?
Oh, absolutely. And in fact, the word of the year phenomenon has actually taken off in some other countries, especially in Europe and East Asia now. Various organizations that are interested in language in different countries now come up with their own words of the year.
Well, your field work took you to Indonesia. What did you study there?
In Indonesia, I was interested in sort of the intersection of language, politics, religion as well. I did field work in West Java, where the Sundanese-speaking group is, about 40 million Sundanese speakers.
That's a lot of people.
It is. It is a fair number. They love to play with language, and a lot of my research was on their sort of language play.
I've always wondered whether Indonesians knew how Westerners would respond to a name like Megawati. She's a former prime minister, now a leader of the opposition. Megawati.
That's true, with megawattage.
You've also taught courses on language and culture at UCLA, Kenyon College, Rutgers University. How much does language affect culture?
Well, language and culture are intricately linked. I mean, it's hard to have one without the other. And so, we look at the interesting ways that language reflects culture and also builds culture through our own sort of interpersonal interactions.
So if a language is structured in a certain way, does that affect the way a culture develops? For example, Japanese is structured quite differently from English, which is structured differently from German, which is structured differently from Chinese, which is structured differently from Russian. Does that affect the way politics is conducted, the way we view each other, because we just we construct sentences differently?
That's actually a raging debate in studies of language and culture, what's sometimes called linguistic relativism. Exactly how much does the structure of language have a role in patterning our thought, our perceptions, our cultural interactions? And, there are sort of people who feel that it has a very strong effect, others that see it as a very weak effect. Obviously, people can have cross-cultural communication even if there are some hiccups along the way. We can translate ideas and thoughts between languages. And so it doesn't mean that we're in a kind of a prison house of language, but it certainly does have an effect on, the way that we sort of build our mental and social worlds.
5 years ago, you were named the editor of American Dictionaries at Oxford University Press. Did that job cause you to refocus your ideas about how Americans use language?
Yeah, by that point, I had shifted out of an academic career into lexicography and then also language commentary. And so moving away from more sort of theoretical issues into really applying knowledge about language and you know, how it can be used for practical purposes, whether it's to build a dictionary, to build a thesaurus, or to connect to a more general audience about language issues and sort of thinking through those issues on a more kind of hands-on and practical level.
And even dictionaries disagree. We wind up with different definitions of the same words in different dictionaries and acceptance of certain words in one dictionary but not another.
That's absolutely true. I mean, it always comes down to a matter of opinion. Very often, in terms of what words should be included in a particular dictionary, how those words should be defined, and so it's fascinating in terms of the way that different dictionary makers approach the task.
How did you get involved with the American Dialect Society? And can anyone become a member?
Anyone can become a member, and anyone is welcome to join us in Portland on January 6th when we have our Word of the Year selection process going on. That's actually something that's open to the public. Or you can go to the website, americandialect.org, to put in your own nominees for our Word of the Year selection. I just got involved because I had this longstanding interest in American English and how it's used, and this is the scholarly organization that really puts that front and center.
Is there a formal nomination process for Word of the Year?
Well, we field nominations from all over, from the public, and as well as from our own membership. When we have our annual meeting in Portland, there's a process of filling out nominees for the main Word of the Year category and also other categories. We have categories like most useful, most likely to succeed, most creative, most euphemistic. So there are a lot of consolation prizes for words that may not end up being the main Word of the Year.
But you call yourself and people like you word watchers. Now, there are people who go back into history to find the original use of the word. I think a few years back we talked to the man who found the first application of the Big Apple to New York City. This is important to a lot of people. The OED, I guess, kind of thrives on that. But in your case, you're looking at them as they're born.
Well, they may be born and brand new, but they may also be new twists on old words. If you take a word like occupy, for instance, that's a very old word. And yet just in the past few months, we can see that brand new resonance, brand new connotations have come up with that old word. Sometimes we can actually sort of watch a word or phrase be born on the fly. Other times we see it sort of percolate up, or perhaps two words may be combined in a new way, blended together, or old words are used in new ways. And so all of that comes into play when we look at the words of the year.
Like Arab Spring.
Two
perfect words that put together mean something totally different. And the way that occupy has come to mean something totally different.
I mean, that's right. And with Arab Spring, I mean, we have the metaphor of the change of seasons, which has been used for revolutions in the past, most famously the Prague Spring of 1968, although it actually goes back to the 18th century in Europe, the so-called Springtime of Nations. And so there's this long tradition of using a spring or springtime to talk about a kind of a new revolutionary spirit. So it made sense to combine Arab and spring, and that quickly became the label that everyone used for what's going on in the Middle East.
Another word that came out of that was Mubarak. I suspect that is a word that won't last very long.
Well, you know, when names are in the news, we love to turn them into nouns, or verbs. We call that making an eponym when you take a noun and turn it into a word. And so Mubarak, when he was about to step down and it seemed like he was just not getting the hint, there were people who were having fun with it on Twitter saying, well, what could we make Mubarak mean as a verb? And so there were suggestions like to fail to get the hint regardless of how obvious it may be. Well, he finally did get the hint and he did step down. But we do that all the time where if there's a name in the news and we create something new in the lexicon out of that name.
And once in a while, they survive, and then we wonder why a certain thing. I can't remember some of the old words that are traditional.
Sure. Well, boycott. Or guillotine there are plenty of those like that. A gerrymander after the governor, Jerry plus salamander, things like that. Yeah.
Although I suspect T-Bowing won't last all that long. Or...
I don't think so. I mean, T-Bowing is this internet meme where you pose in the manner of Denver Broncos quarterback Tim Tebow, who's a religious fellow and poses. He has this sort of prayer stance that he uses, and so people kind of poke fun of that by posing in a similar way and calling that T-Bowing.
Now, there are a lot of words that you suddenly hear that have been around for a while. Our listeners, in fact, suggested debt crisis, Eurozone, vetted. These are not new words. These would not really qualify, would they?
Well, when we talk about Word of the Year for the American Dialect Society, it doesn't necessarily have to be brand new. It can be newly significant. And again, Occupy is a perfect example of that. That goes back for centuries, but it certainly is newly significant, has new meanings along the way. And so that's really what we're looking at, rather than having to only look at words that have been coined in the past year.
But have things changed? Twitter and Facebook were a central part of the Arab Spring. Did the fact that these revolutions were fueled by social media affect the language of the movements?
I think it may.
And
have.
Occupy being another case.
Sure. I mean, Occupy is a terrific example of that. And, you know, we did see that earlier in the year with Egypt the way that social media, especially Twitter, is playing a role in not just sort of getting the word out and mobilizing people, but affecting the kinds of slogans and other sort of word uses that people use to rally around. And so just that word Occupy, originally in Occupy Wall Street, ended up becoming this imperative verb, occupy, and then it could just be used as a noun to modify other nouns like the Occupy movement, Occupy protest. And a lot of that happened on Twitter thanks to just using something like Occupy as a hashtag. It ends up having this sort of powerful oomph that it gets just being used in that context.
Well, people now will say, I went to the Occupy site.
Exactly, right. And you know what that means. Or you can talk about occupiers, or you can describe the site as the occupation and so forth. And so all the different forms of Occupy have taken off. And, of course, there have been plenty of parodies as well, everything from Occupy Sesame Street to Occupy My Couch.
You mentioned a few U.S. foreign policy words in your article. What are those? Dether?
With the deather, a deather,
a deather.
Yeah,
oh,
right. A deather is someone who did not actually believe that Osama bin Laden was killed, and so
that's a take on birthing,
birther
right. From last year,
right? So there are birthers and deathers, different types of conspiracy theories using that er ending,
and then there's leading from behind, which caused a stir when the president used it.
Well, actually, that appeared in a New Yorker article this year, quoting an Obama administration official who was not named as describing the Obama administration's policy in Libya. And even though leading from behind has a kind of a distinguished pedigree, Nelson Mandela talked about leading from behind, the Republican opponents of Obama quickly seized upon that. We heard a lot about it in the Republican debates, and we're sure to hear a lot about it when the Republicans are slamming Obama for foreign policy in the campaign season next year as well.
What happens with a word like homeland? When it was first proposed, Department of Homeland Security, many people heard almost authoritarian or totalitarian strains in it. Has it just calmed down, and is it just part of the vocabulary now?
I think so. That's an interesting case. Certainly when the Office of Homeland Security was created after 9/11, there was a lot of critique of that word choice because, as you say, it had this kind of fascistic overtone to it for some people, seeming to remind people of Nazi Germany or something like that. But it is something that people have gotten used to. You don't hear those complaints so much anymore. So that very often happens where a word just becomes part of our, you know, regular discourse. And so the misgivings that people have early on sometimes just fade away.
My guest is Ben Zimmer, who is the executive producer of visualthesaurus.com and vocabulary.com. He writes a biweekly language column for the Boston Globe. And we are talking about some of the words he'll be featuring in this coming Sunday's installment of the column, which deals with the words that have been nominated for Word of the Year to be chosen somewhere in January, words that shaped the year from humble brag to bunga bunga. And we will continue our conversation after we take a little break. Stay with us. We are back with Ben Zimmer. We're talking about the words of 2011. Should we distinguish between words that get adjusted and invented words? Let's talk about some of the invented words.
Well, sure. One of my favorites that was invented this year was humble brag. Certainly the whole idea of fake humility has been around for quite a long time. But on Twitter, it has taken on new significance thanks to celebrities getting on Twitter and tweeting about how hard their lives are, how tough it is to have so many bathrooms in their mansion or where to put their Emmy Awards or whatever. A comedian came up with this term humble brag to describe this type of tweeting that was going on. And it's perfect. I mean, it really kind of identified this phenomenon, made it funny, and it is also a way that shows how people were sort of thinking about language and the way we use it on new media like Twitter.
Then there's gamification.
Gamification, that's right. I mean, that's when you use sort of game-like qualities and for things that are not actually games. And I mean, if you think about again something like Twitter, where people are thinking, oh, I want to have more followers and more retweets. They're thinking in kind of a game-like mode, and that kind of gamification is taking over a lot of our lives, where we want to score more points, unlock new achievements, and so forth. People developing new products and new services are playing into our desire to be on top.
So Twitter is a word that was introduced a few years back, now part of the regular usage. But if something else comes along within a couple of years that replaces Twitter, will we still be saying Twitter 5 years from now?
Well, that's a good question. I mean, these social media such as Facebook, Twitter, Google Plus, or whatever the next thing might be, Tumblr, and so forth.
Before Facebook, there was another version of that, and I've even forgotten its name.
Well, there was Friendster, which has been forgotten about. So these things come in waves, obviously. Twitter has been a pretty huge phenomenon for sure, as has Facebook, of course. And so those don't seem to be going away in the near future, and their effect on language will continue, at least for the foreseeable future.
In September, you wrote an article called The Rise of the Zuckerverb in The Atlantic. That relates to what we're talking about here, doesn't it? Did you invent the word Zuckerverb?
I did. Sometimes I like to coin my own words and just let them loose in the wild and see if people pick them up. And so for the headline for that piece on The Atlantic, I coined the term Zuckerverb, taking Mark Zuckerberg's name. And that article was about how Facebook had discovered verbs. And so it was not simply just a matter now of liking something, but now on Facebook you can say that you are watching a particular movie, listening to a particular song, all sorts of different types of media consumption as well as kind of lifestyle activities that can now be part of your Facebook timeline.
And then there's Twitterology, which is pretty much the same sort of thing, people telling us what they're eating at that given moment.
Well, Twitterology was something I wrote about for the New York Times, where I was actually talking more about the scholarly look at Twitter. Twitter has become this incredible gold mine for language researchers because it's this fire hose of language data that they can use to track new forms of language, to look at sentiment analysis, for instance, how people are feeling on the ground in Libya, for instance, when Gaddafi was deposed and killed. Twitterology is this burgeoning new field, this new kind of science that I wrote about.
Some other words, NARB, NIMWARS, FOMO, which is written all in caps.
Right. So NARB is short for narrative bit. And that the Facebook thing that we were talking about, where you stitch together all the narrative bits about your life, a scholar said we could call that NARBs. NIMWARS was something that happened on Google Plus, where people wanted to remain anonymous, even though Google Plus insisted people use their real names. And so people who wanted to use pseudonyms launched a NIMWAR. And then finally, FOMO is a great acronym, F-O-M-O, that is fear of missing out, which I think a lot of us felt, especially with things like Facebook and Twitter, where we're constantly deluged with what everyone is doing, what everyone is saying, and you can never keep up. You can be on your smartphone or your computer all day long trying to keep track of what's happening out there in the world in your own social circle and more broadly, and it's just too much. You just feel overwhelmed by this fear of missing out, or FOMO.
Perhaps the most lighthearted nominees come from the realm of pop culture. What is some of them? The first one that comes to my mind is two different things, Winning / Tiger's Blood.
Right. I mean, that was at the beginning of the year when many of us were focused on the rather unhinged things that Charlie Sheen was saying in his rants that were quite widely publicized. And he certainly played into people's fascination with this seemingly public breakdown that he was having. And so his mantras like winning and tiger blood became catchphrases. And that's died off a bit. I mean, after that whole sort of Sheen fad has faded away a bit, although you still hear people use that in that particular Sheen intonation of winning as often a kind of a sarcastic expression of self-confidence.
But tiger seems to have been a good word this year. And also, there was Tiger Mother.
That's right. That's right. Amy Chua's book, The Battle Hymn of the Tiger Mother, got a lot of attention. And so there was a talk of tiger moms. So we had Tiger Blood. So there were some other examples of tigers as well. So it was definitely a good year for that word.
And then some of the other pop culture words, planking and its variants, owling, horse maning. There was lip dub. There's brony.
So many, yeah. So a brony, for instance, that combines bro and pony. There were these male adult fans of the My Little Pony franchise, believe it or not, and they call their little subculture bronies. And then you
have to know what My Little Pony is,
right? There's a new version of this cartoon on television now, which seems to be aimed for young girls, and yet for some reason these bros are interested in it as well. Lip dubs are these elaborately staged lip-syncing videos that are posted. You could have your office lip-sync to a particular song, or you could even have a whole town. The city of Grand Rapids had this enormous lip dub I think it was American Pie. And so, all these words show that, you know, a lot of pop culture is often very frivolous, and maybe that's a good release when the economic picture is so gloomy and we need a diversion.
Although that could have gone all the way back to Milli Vanilli, couldn't it? And even earlier, people have been lip-dubbing ever since television forced them to sing their songs.
American Bandstand. Right. The whole lip-syncing phenomenon has been around for a while, but now
there's even somebody named Lipsynka who has where she he/she lip syncs.
Well, now it's sort of the democratization of that. Everybody can lip sync to somebody else's song and make it into a whole big production and put it on YouTube now.
My guest is Ben Zimmer. We're talking about the words of the year, the possible words, the possibility that one of these words will actually win word of the year. And we invite your calls at 212-433-9692. You can leave a comment on our show page at WNYC.org. I'm Leonard Lopate, and this is WNYC, WNYC.org. A listener in Manhattan writes, I'm personally obsessed with how the hashtag has been integrated into our lexicon. I find them humorous when used at the end of a sentence to punctuate the idea. I guess we should say, thanks, Twitter.
Well, yeah. I mean, the hashtag has been one of the great innovations of Twitter. And so, you know, we talked about it in relation to Occupy, where a term like Occupy, or there are other examples we could talk about, a word like fail, for instance, takes on new power and a kind of a new punch when it's used as a hashtag on Twitter. And so I think also Charlie Sheen's winning has been used quite often as a hashtag, and that probably contributed to the popularization of that term.
So these are all things that would not have even been considered 15, 20 years ago. The technology determines to some degree the kinds of words we even consider.
To some degree, although we should be careful not to have our blinders on too much if we're kind of people who live their lives on Twitter or Facebook might think that's all that's happening in the world. But it's important to remember that things like, for instance, humble brag might not have too much resonance for people who are not constantly on Twitter. So that's something to keep in mind.
We talked about Occupy, but there are other phrases that have come out of the Occupy movement. 99% means something. 1% means something.
That's right. I mean, very early on in the Occupy Wall Street movement, this slogan, "We are the 99%," started. And again, thanks to social media, it started on a Tumblr where "We are the 99%" became popularized. And so that the idea that 1% of the population controls an outsized a segment of the economy had been floating around, but it became sloganized as "We are the 99%." And so now the whole idea of the 99% versus the 1% has really become part of the political and economic discourse in the country.
And then we have all sorts of other phrases. I never would have understood what human microphone meant a year ago.
Yeah, well, that deals more specifically with what is happening at these occupations, the Occupy protests, where these forms of mass communication are being used. But because originally in Zuccotti Park here in New York, they couldn't use any amplification by megaphone and that sort of thing. They came up with this system which had been used in other protests, the people's microphone or the human microphone, where one person says something and then it's repeated by the people around them and then perhaps by another phalanx of people around them as a way of getting the word out. And so that became very much part of the Occupy culture, along with the hand movements that they use to signify agreement or disagreement. They call that twinkling or sometimes jazz hands.
Jake from Flushing, hi, you're on the air.
Yeah, hi. My comment is this conversation, while very interesting, it sort of reminds me of a bit that they did on Saturday Night Live a couple of years ago where Seth Meyers on the headline news that they do had this thing where it said, you know, oh, new word being introduced is non-trays, which is a word to describe a meal that is neither an entree or an appetizer. He said, and oh, this just in, nobody is using the term non-tray.
Right.
Really, outside of, you know, The New Yorker and New York Magazine, maybe my Details magazine subscription, are these really terms that people use in everyday conversation, or this is just sort of like something that's sort of in the popular culture press, if you will?
Well, yeah. I mean, many of these terms may be kind of fly-by-night, flash-in-the-pan neologisms that don't really have much staying power. We're often attracted to what's new and shiny without really thinking about the long-term impact. But I certainly would think that something like Occupy certainly has is going to have a long-term impact on the use of that word and you know the way that has sort of infiltrated our discourse. Other examples that we've been talking about, we may have forgotten in a year's time, it is true.
Okay.
Thank you very much. Thanks for taking my call.
And we go now to Tom from Seabright, New Jersey. Hi, Tom.
Hi, good afternoon. The governor in this state, his name is Christie, and in some local papers and circles, they're referring to him as the Gov'n-Eater, you know, like a play on the Terminator and the Gov'n-Eater with, I don't know if it's going to spread outside of the Monmouth County, Central Jersey area in Democratic circles anyway, but maybe since he's flacking for Romney, maybe it will start catching on. I don't know. Boy, if you think it has any legs.
Well, does Gov'n-Eater have any legs now that Arnold Schwarzenegger is no longer governor of California?
Yeah, I think it was more often called the gubernator, which sounds, mm-hmm. From like gubernatorial. You turn that into gubernator, which sounds even better. I'm from New Jersey, and so I'm used to the jeers about Christie and his weight and so forth. And so I can see govern-eater being a playful spin on that. But that I think would remain limited to people who are having fun just with Christie and his image.
So when will the committee meet to vote for the word of the year?
Well, we'll be meeting on January 6th at our annual meeting in Portland, Oregon this year. As I mentioned, it's open to the public. If you want more information, you can go to americandialect.org. And there's all the information about how you can submit your own nominations, or if you're actually interested in attending, you can do that as well.
Well, we've seen a lot of election problems over the past year. Can we expect some ballot stuffing in this case?
It's all done in the open by a show of hands. We don't use twinkling or jazz hands, but we do raise our hands and vote on the different candidates. And then very often we have to have a runoff in the different categories between the top two vote getters. And so it's all out in the open, and the debate is very lively and very lighthearted, too.
And are there any lobbying campaigns among members or outside influences? Does Harvey Weinstein get involved in this?
We haven't yet been infiltrated by that. But within the organization, there are certainly people who are kind of lobbying for their favorite candidates. But it's still the people in the room get to vote and make the decision.
Is there a sense that there are certain words that are leading right now?
Well, Occupy does seem to be the front runner, and it's hard to think of another word that would displace it necessarily for the main category of Word of the Year, but you never know. Someone may nominate a word from the floor, and then people say, yeah, that's what we should be talking about. So, for instance, last year was APP, A-P-P, short for application, and, of course, that has become quite common. And then the year before that, tweet. And both of those tech examples, tweet and app, were ones that were nominated from the floor, and then people said, yeah, let's choose that one. So you never know what might happen.
Although in the case of Occupy, it's become an international word. We're seeing Occupy movements all over the world. So maybe this has a certain kind of a resonance, unlike Bunga Bunga, where the Italian committee might vote for it, but maybe not anybody else.
That's true. And, there are various other Word of the Year selections, and Oxford Dictionaries, where I used to work, from the UK, they selected squeezed middle, this term that's been used by Labour Party politicians in the UK to describe how the middle class is feeling squeezed by the economic conditions there. I see that as rather limited to the UK and what people are talking about there. I don't really hear people in the U.S. using that term. So, yeah, it's true.
Even though we do talk about a squeezed middle here.
Well, true, but we might say that in we might use different words to describe that phenomenon. Exactly, yeah.
I want to thank you so much for being with us again, Ben Zimmer, who writes a biweekly column for the Boston Globe. And this Sunday, his article will be The Talk of 2011, Words That Shaped the Year from Humble Brag to Bunga Bunga. And we will offer a link to that when it is available to us. Meanwhile, I want to thank you so much for being with us today. And I'm assuming Occupy is going to win.
Well, we'll see. But it does seem like it's the prohibitive front runner right now.